voice dry. "And you may never order me arrested or imprisoned or killed," I said, ignoring him. "Nor hurt. Nor even detained."
"What about asking a servant to put a very sharp pebble in your boot?"
he asked, expression annoyingly serious. I gave him what I hoped was a scathing look in return. "Nor may you raise a hand against me yourself." He made a gesture in the air, as though all of this was ridiculously obvious, as though somehow giving him the commands out loud was an act of bad faith. I went doggedly on. "Each evening, you will meet me in your rooms before dinner, and we will discuss policy. And if you know of harm to be done to me, you must warn me. You must try to prevent anyone from guessing how I control you. And no matter how much you hate being High King, you must pretend otherwise."
"I don't,"
he said, looking up at the sky. I turned to him, surprised. "What do you mean?"
"I don't hate being High King,"
he said.
"Not always. I thought I would. And yet, I do not. Make of that what you will."
I was unnerved, because it was a lot easier when I knew he was not just unsuitable for, but also uninterested in, ruling. Whenever I looked at the blood crown on his head, I had to pretend it away. It didn't help how immediately he'd convinced the gentry of his right to preside over them. His reputation for cruelty made them wary of crossing him. His license made them believe all delights were possible. "So," I said, "you enjoy being my pawn?" He grinned lazily, as though he didn't mind being baited.
"For now."
My gaze sharpened.
"For far longer than that."
"You've won yourself a year and a day,"
he told me.
"But a lot can happen in a year and a day. Give me all the commands you want, but you'll never think of everything."
Once, I was the one to throw him off balance, the one to ignite his anger and shred his self-control. But somehow the tables turned. Every day since, I've felt the slippage. As I gaze at him now, stretched out on my bed, I feel more off balance than ever. The roach sweeps into the room late that afternoon. On his shoulder is the hob-faced owl. Once a messenger for Dane, now a messenger for the Court of Shadows. It goes by Snapdragon, although I don't know if that's a code name.
"The Living Council wants to see you,"
the roach says. Snapdragon blinks sleepy black eyes at me. I groan.
"In truth,"
he says, nodding toward the bed.
"They want to see him, but it's you they can order around."
I stand and stretch. Then, strapping on the sheath, I head into the parlor of my apartments so as not to wake Carden. "How's the ghost?"
"Resting,"
the roach says.
"Lot of rumors flying around about last night, even among the palace guard. Gossips begin to spin their webs."
I head to my bath chamber to clean myself up. I gargle with salty water and scrub my face and armpits with a cloth slathered in lemony verbena soap. I brush out my tangles, too exhausted to manage anything more complicated than that. "I guess you checked the passageway by now," I call out.
"I did,"
the roach says.
"And I see why it wasn't on any of our maps. There's no connection to the other passageways at any point down the length of it. I'm not even sure it was built when they were."
I consider the painting of the clock and the constellations, the stars prophesying an amorous lover. "Who slept there before Carden?" I ask. The roach shrugs.
"Several folk. No one of particular note. Guests of the crown."
"Lovers," I say, finally putting it together. "The High King's lovers who weren't consorts."
"Huh."
The roach indicates Carden with the lift of his chin in the direction of my bedroom.
"And that's the place our High King chose to sleep.
The roach gives me a significant look, as though I am supposed to know the answer to this puzzle, when I didn't even realize it was a puzzle at all. I don't know, I say. He shakes his head.
You best get to that council meeting.
I can't say it's not a relief to know that when Cardin wakes, I won't be there.
Chapter 7. The Living Council was assembled during Eldred's time, ostensibly to help the High King make decisions, and they have calcified into a group difficult to oppose. It's not so much that the ministers have raw individual power, although many are themselves formidable, but as a collective, it has the authority to make many smaller decisions regarding the running of the kingdom, the kind of small decisions that, taken together, could put even a king in a bind. After the disrupted coronation and the murder of the royal family, after the irregularity with the crown, the council is skeptical of Cardin's youth and confused by my rise to power. Snapdragon leads me to the meeting, beneath a braided dome of willow trees at a table of fossilized wood. The ministers watch me walk across the grass, and I look at them in turn. The unseelie minister, a troll with a thick head of shaggy hair, with pieces of metal braided into it. The seelie minister, a green woman who looks like a mantis. The grand general, Matic. The royal astrologer, a very tall, dark-skinned man with a sculpted beard and celestial ornaments in the long fall of his navy blue hair. The Minister of Keys, a wizened old hob with ram's horns and goat eyes, and the Grand Fool, who wears pale lavender roses on his head to match his purple motley. All along the table are carafes of water and wine, dishes of dried fruit. I lean over to one of the servants and send them for a pot of the strongest tea they can find. I will need it. Randolin, the Minister of Keys, sits in the High King's chair. The wooden back of the throne-like seat is burned with the royal crest. I note the move, and the assumptions inherent in it. In the 5 months since assuming the mantle of High King, Cardin has not come to the council. Only one chair is empty, between Matic and Fala, the Grand Fool. I remain standing.
Jew Duarte, says Randolin, fixing me with his goat eyes. Where is the High King?
Standing in front of them is always intimidating, and Maddox's presence makes it worse. He makes me feel like a child, overeager to say or do something clever. A part of me wants nothing more than to prove I am more than what they suppose me to be. The weak and silly appointee of a weak and silly king. To prove that there is another reason for Cardin to have chosen a mortal seneschal than because I can lie for him. I am here in his place, I say, to speak in his stead. Randolin's gaze is withering.
There is a rumor that he shot one of his paramours last night. Is it true?
A servant sets the asked-for pot of tea at my elbow, and I am grateful both for the fortification and for an excuse not to immediately answer.
Today, courtiers told me that girl wore an anklet of swinging ruby sent to her in apology, but was unable to stand on her own,
says Nior, the Seelie representative. She purses her small green lips.
I find everything about that to be in poor taste.
Fala, the fool, laughs, clearly finding it to his taste.
Rubies for the spilling of her ruby-red blood.
That couldn't be true. Cardin would have had to arrange it in the time it took me to get from my rooms to the council. But that doesn't mean someone else didn't arrange it on his behalf. Everyone is eager to help a king. You'd prefer he'd killed her outright, I say? My skills in diplomacy are nowhere near as honed as my skills in aggravation. Besides, I'm tired.
I wouldn't mind,
says the Unseelie representative, Miguel, with a chuckle.
Our new High King seems Unseelie through and through, and he will favor us, I think. We could give him a debauch better than the one his Master of Revels brags over, now that we know what he likes.
There are other stories, continues Randolin, that one of the guards shot High King Cardin to save that courtier's life, that she is bearing the royal heir. You must tell the High King that his council stands ready to advise him so that his rule is not plagued by such tales.
I'll be sure to do so, I say. The royal astrologer, Baefin, gives me a searching look, as though reading correctly my intention not to talk to Cardin about any of this.
The High King is tied to the land and to his subjects. A king is a living symbol, a beating heart, a star upon which Elfheim's future is written.
He speaks quietly, and yet somehow his voice carries.
Surely you have noticed that since his reign began, the Isles are different. Storms come in faster. Colors are a bit more vivid. Smells are sharper. Things have been seen in the forests,
he goes on.
Ancient things, long thought gone from the world, come to peer at him. When he becomes drunk, his subjects become tipsy without knowing why. When his blood falls, things grow. Why? High Queen Mab called Innsmire, Innsmore, and Innsweel from the sea. All the Isles of Elfheim formed in a single hour.
My heart speeds faster the longer that Baefin talks. My lungs feel as though they cannot get enough air, because none of this can be describing Cardin. He cannot be connected to the land so profoundly, cannot be able to do all that, and yet be under my control. I think of the blood on his coverlet, and beside it, the scattered white flowers. When his blood falls, things grow.
And so, you see,
says Randolin, unaware that I am freaking out.
The High King's every decision changes Elfheim and influences its inhabitants. During Eldred's reign, when children were born, they were perforce brought before him to pledge themselves to the kingdom. But in the low courts, some heirs were fostered in the mortal world, growing up outside of Eldred's reach. Those changeling children returned to rule without making vows to the blood crown. At least one court has made such a changeling its queen. And who knows how many wild folk managed to avoid making vows. And the general of the Court of Teeth, Grima Mog, seems to have left her post. No one is sure what she intends. We can ill afford carelessness on the part of the High King.
I've heard of Grima Mog. She is terrifying, but not as terrifying as Orla. We need to watch the Queen of the Undersea, too, I say. She's got a plan, and is going to move against us.
What's this?
Maddox says, interested in the conversation for the first time.
Impossible, says Randolin. How would you have heard such a thing?
Baelkin has been meeting with her representatives, I say. Randolin snorts.
And I suppose you have that from the prince's own lips?
If I bit my tongue any harder, I'd bite clean through it. I have it from more than one source. If their alliance was with Eldred, then it's over.
The sea folk have cold hearts,
Mikkel says, which sounds at first as though he's agreeing with me, but the approving tone of his voice undermines it.
Why doesn't Baefin consult his star charts?
Randolin says placatingly.
If he finds a threat prophesied there, we shall discuss further.
I am telling you, I insist, frustrated. That is the moment that Fala jumps up on the table and begins to dance. Interpretively, I think. Madoc grunts out a laugh. A bird alights on Nyur's shoulder, and they begin gossiping back and forth in low whispers and trills. It is clear that none of them wants to believe me. How could I know something they do not, after all? I am too young, too green, too mortal. Nikasia, I begin again. Madoc smiles.
Your little friend? From school?
I wish I could tell Madoc that the only reason he still sits on the council is because of me. Despite his running Dane through with his own hand, he is still the Grand General. I could say that I want to keep him busy, that he's a weapon better deployed by us than against us, that it's easier for my spies to watch him when I know where he is. But a part of me knows he is still Grand General, because I couldn't bring myself to strip so much authority from my dad.
There is still the matter of Grimson, says Mikkel,
moving on as though I have not spoken.
The High King has welcomed the Alder King Smith, maker of the Blood Crown. Now he dwells among us, but does not yet labor for us.
We must make him welcome, says Nior in a rare moment of sympathy between the Unseelie and Seelie factions. The Master of Revels has made plans for the Hunter's Moon. Perhaps he can add entertainment for Grimson's benefit.
Depends on what Grimson's into, I guess, I say, giving up on convincing them that Orla is going to move against us. I am on my own.
Rooting in the dirt, mayhap, Fala says. Looking for trifles.
Truffles,
Randolin corrects automatically.
Oh no, says Fala, wrinkling his nose. Not those.
I will endeavor to discover his preferred amusements.
Randolin makes a small note on a piece of paper.
I have also been told that a representative from the Court of Termites will be attending the Hunter's Moon Revel.
I try not to let my surprise show. The Court of Termites, led by Lord Roivin, was helpful in getting Cardin onto the throne. And for their efforts, I promised that when Lord Roivin asked me for a favor, I'd do it. But I have no idea what he might want. And now isn't a good time for another complication. Randolin clears his throat and turns, giving me a pointed look.
Convey our regrets to the High King that we were unable to advise him directly. And let him know we stand ready to come to his aid. If you fail to impress this upon him, we will find other means of doing so.
I make a short bow and no reply to what is clearly a threat. As I leave, Madoc falls into step alongside me.
I understand. You've spoken with your sister, he says,
thick eyebrows lowered in at least a mimicry of concern. I shrug, reminding myself that he didn't speak a word on my behalf today. He gives me an impatient look.
Don't tell me how busy you are with that boy, King. Though I imagine he takes some looking after.
Somehow, in just a few words, he has turned me into a sullen daughter, and himself into her long-suffering father. I sigh, defeated. I've spoken with Taryn.
Good,
he says.
You're too much alone.
Don't pretend at solicitude, I say. It insults us both.
You don't believe that I could care about you, even after you betrayed me.
He watches me with his cat eyes.
I'm still your father.
You're my father's murderer, I blurt out.
I can be both,
Madoc says, smiling, showing those teeth. I tried to rattle him, but I succeeded only in rattling myself. Despite the passage of months,
The memory of his final aborted lunge once he realized he was poisoned is fresh in my mind. I remember his looking as though he would have liked to cleave me in half. Which is why neither of us should pretend you're not furious with me.
Oh, I'm angry, daughter. But I'm also curious.
He makes a dismissive gesture toward the palace of Elfheim.
Is this really what you wanted? Him?
As with Taryn, I choke on the explanation I cannot give. When I do not speak, he comes to his own conclusions.
As I thought. I didn't appreciate you properly. I dismissed your desire for knighthood. I dismissed your capacity for strategy, for strength, and for cruelty. That was my mistake, and one I will not make again.
I am not sure if that's a threat or an apology.
Cardin is the High King now, and so long as he wears the blood crown, I am sworn to serve him,
he says.
But no oath binds you. If you regret your move, make another. There are games yet to play.
I already won, I remind him. He smiles.
We will speak again.
As he walks off, I can't help thinking that maybe I was better off when he was ignoring me. Chapter 8. I meet the bomb in High King Eldred's old rooms. This time I am resolved to go over every inch of the chambers before Cardin is moved into them, and I am determined he should stay here, in the most secure part of the palace, whatever his preferences might be. When I arrive, the bomb is lighting the last of the fat candles above a fireplace, the runnels of wax so established that they make a kind of sculpture. It is strange to be in here now, without an acacia to buttonhole or anything else to distract me from looking around. The walls shimmer with mica, and the ceiling is all branches and green vines. In the antechamber, the shell of an enormous snail glows, a lamp the size of a small table. The bomb gives me a quick grin. Her white hair is pulled back into braids knotted with a few shimmering silver beads. Someone you trust has already betrayed you. I try to put Nikasia's words out of my head. After all, that could mean anything. It's typical fairy bullshit. Ominous, but applicable so broadly that it could be the clue to a trap about to be sprung on me, or a reference to something that happened when we were all taking lessons together. Maybe she is warning me that a spy is in my confidence. Or maybe she's alluding to Terran's having it off with Locke. And yet, I cannot stop thinking about it.
So the assassin got away through here, the bomb says. The ghost says you chased after them.
I shake my head. There was no assassin. It was a romantic misunderstanding. Her eyebrows go up. The High King is very bad at romance, I say.
I guess so, she says. So you want to toss the sitting room, and I'll take the bedroom?
Sure. I agree, heading toward it. The secret passageway is beside a fireplace, carved like the grinning mouth of a goblin. The bookshelf is still shifted to one side, revealing spiraling steps up into the walls. I close it.
You really think you can get Cardin to move in here?
The bomb calls from the other room.
It's such a waste to have all this glorious space go unused.
I lean down to start pulling books off the shelves, opening them and shaking them a bit to see if there's anything inside. A few yellowing and disintegrating pieces of paper fall out, along with a feather and a carved bone letter opener. Someone hollowed one of the books out, but nothing rests inside the compartment. Still another tome has been eaten away by insects. I throw that one out. The last room Cardin occupied caught fire, I call back to the bomb. Let me rephrase. It caught fire because he lit it on fire. She laughs.
It would take him days to burn all this.
I look back at the books,
and I'm not so sure. They are dry enough to burst into flames just by my looking at them too long. With a sigh, I stack them and move on to the cushions, to pulling back the rugs. Underneath, I find only dust. I dump out all the drawers onto the massive table-sized desk, the metal nibs of quill pens, stones carved with faces, three signet rings, a long tooth of a creature I cannot identify, and three vials with the liquid inside, dried black and solid. In another drawer, I find jewels, a collar of black jet, a beaded bracelet with a clasp, heavy golden rings. In the last, I find quartz crystals, cut into smooth, polished globes and spheres. When I lift one to the light, something moves inside it. "Bomb?" I call, my voice a little high. She comes into the room, carrying a jeweled coat so heavily encrusted that I'm surprised anyone was willing to stand in it.
"What's wrong? Have you ever seen anything like this before?"
I hold up a crystal ball. She peers into it.
"Look, there's Dane."
I take it back and look inside. A young Prince Dane sits on the back of a horse, holding a bow in one hand and apples in the other. Elowyn sits on a pony to one side of him, and Raya to the other. He throws three apples in the air, and all of them draw their bows and shoot.
"Did that happen?" I ask.
"Probably," she says. "Someone must have enchanted these orbs for Eldred."
I think of Grimson's legendary swords, of the golden acorn that disgorged Liriope's last words, of Mother Marrow's cloth that could turn even the sharpest blade, and all the mad magic that High Kings are given. These were common enough to be stuffed away into a drawer. I pull out each one to see what's inside. I see Balekin as a newborn child, the thorns already growing out of his skin. He squalls in the arms of a mortal midwife, her gaze glazed with glamour.
"Look into this one," the bomb says, with a strange expression.
It's Cardin as a very small child. He is dressed in a shirt that's too large for him. It hangs down like a gown. He is barefoot, his feet and shirt streaked with mud. But he wears dangling hoops in his ears, as though an adult gave him their earrings. A horned fairy woman stands nearby, and when he runs to her, she grabs his wrists before he can put his dirty hands on her skirts. She says something stern and shoves him away. When he falls, she barely notices, too busy being drawn into conversation with other courtiers. I expect Cardin to cry, but he doesn't. Instead, he stomps off to a tree that an older boy is climbing. The boy says something, and Cardin grabs for his ankle. A moment later, the boy is on the ground, and Cardin's small, grubby hand is forming a fist. At the sound of the scuffle, the fairy woman turns and laughs, clearly delighted by his escapade. When Cardin looks back at her, he's smiling too. I shove the crystal back into the drawer. Who would cherish this? It's horrible. And yet, it's not dangerous. There's no reason to do anything with it, but leave it where it was. The bomb and I continue through the room together. Once we're satisfied it's safe, we head through a door carved with an owl, back into the king's bedchamber. A massive half-tester bed rests in the center, curtained in green, with the symbol of the Greenbrier line stitched in gleaming gold. Thick spider silk blankets are smoothed out over a mattress that smells as though it has been stuffed with flowers.
"Come on," says the bomb,
flopping down on the bed and rolling over so that she is looking up at the ceiling.
"Let's make sure it's safe for our new High King. Just in case."
I suck in a surprised breath, but follow. My weight on the mattress makes it dip, and the heady scent of roses overwhelms my senses. Spreading out on the High King of Elfheim's coverlets,
breathing in the air that perfumed his nights, has an almost hypnotic quality. The bomb pillows her head in her arms, as though it's no big thing. But I remember High King Eldred's hand on my head, and the slight jolt of nerves and pride I felt each time he acknowledged me. Lying on his bed feels like wiping my dirty peasant feet on the throne. And yet, how could I not?
"Our king is a lucky duck," the bomb says. "I'd like a bed like this. Big enough to have a guest. Or two."
"Oh yeah?" I ask,
teasing her as I would have once teased my sisters.
"Anyone in particular?"
She looks away, embarrassed, which makes me pay attention. I push myself up on one elbow.
"Wait, is it someone I know?"
For a moment, she doesn't answer, which is long enough.
"It is." "The ghost?"
"Jude," she says. "No."
I frown at her. "The roach?"
The bomb sits up, long fingers pulling the coverlet to her. Since she cannot lie, she only sighs.
"You don't understand."
The bomb is beautiful, delicate features, and warm brown skin, wild white hair, and luminous eyes. I think of her as possessing some combination of charm and skill that means she could have anyone she wanted. The roach's black tongue, and his twisted nose, and the tuft of fur-like hair at the top of his scalp add up to his being impressive and terrifying. But even according to the aesthetics of fairyland, even in a place where inhuman beauty is celebrated along with almost opulent ugliness, I am not sure even he would guess that the bomb longs for him. I would never have guessed it. I don't know how to say that to her without sounding as though I am insulting him, however.
"I guess I don't," I concede.
She draws a pillow onto her lap.
"My people died in a brutal, internecine court war a century ago, leaving me on my own. I went into the human world and became a small-time crook. I wasn't particularly good at it. Mostly, I was just using glamour to hide my mistakes. That's when the roach spotted me. He pointed out that while I might not be much of a thief, I was a dab hand at concocting potions and bombs. We went around together for decades. He was so affable, so dapper and charming, that he'd con people right to their faces. No magic required."
I smile at the thought of him in a derby hat and a vest with a pocket watch, amused by the world and everything in it.
"Then he had this idea. We were going to steal from the Court of Teeth in the north. The con went wrong. The court carved us up and filled us full of curses and gashes. Changed us. Forced us to serve them."
She snaps her fingers, and sparks fly.
"Fun, right?"
"I bet it wasn't," I say. She flops back and keeps talking.
"The roach. Van. I can't call him the roach while I'm talking like this. Van's the one who got me through being there. He told me stories. Tales of Queen Mab's imprisoning a frost giant. Of binding all the great monsters of yore. And winning the high crown. Stories of the impossible. Without Van, I don't know if I could have survived. Then we screwed up a job. And Dane got hold of us. He had a scheme for us to betray the Court of Teeth and join him. So we did. The ghost was already by his side. And the three of us made a formidable team. Me with explosives. The roach stealing anything or anyone. And the ghost, a sharpshooter with a light step. And here we are, somehow safe in the Court of Elfheim, working for the High King himself. Look at me, sprawled across his royal bed even. But here there's no reason for Van to take my hand, or sing to me when I am hurting. There is no reason for him to bother with me at all.
She lapses into silence. We both stare up at the ceiling. You should tell him, I say. Which is not bad advice, I think. Not advice I would take myself. But that doesn't necessarily make it bad.
Perhaps.
The bomb pushes herself up off the bed.
No tricks or traps. You think it's safe to let our king in here?
I think of the boy in the crystal. Of his proud smile and his bald fist. I think of the horned fairy woman, who must have been his mother, shoving him away from her. I think of his father, the High King, who didn't bother to intervene. Didn't even bother to make sure he was clothed or his face wiped. I think of how Cardin avoided these rooms. I sigh. I wish I could think of a place he'd be safer. At midnight, I am expected to attend a banquet. I sit several seats from the throne and pick at a course of crisped eels. A trio of pixies sings a cappella for us as courtiers try to impress one another with their wit. Overhead, chandeliers drip wax in long strands. High King Cardin smiles down the table indulgently and yawns like a cat. His hair is messy, as though he did no more than finger comb it since rising from my bed. Our eyes meet, and I am the one who looks away, my face hot. Kiss me until I am sick of it. Wine is brought in colored carafes. They glow aquamarine and sapphire, citrine and ruby, amethyst and topaz. Another course comes, with sugared violets and frozen dew. Then come domes of glass, under which little silvery fish sit in a cloud of pale blue smoke.
From the undersea,
says one of the cooks, dressed for the occasion. She bows. I look across the table at Randolin, Minister of Keys, but he is pointedly ignoring me. All around me, the domes rise, and the smoke, redolent of peppercorns and herbs, fills the room. I see that Locke has seated himself beside Cardin, drawing the girl whose seat it was onto his lap. She kicks up her hooved feet and throws back her horned head in laughter.
Ah, says Cardin, lifting up a gold ring from his plate. I see my fish has something in its belly.
And mine,
says a courtier on his other side, picking out a single shiny pearl as large as a thumbnail. She laughs with delight.
A gift from the sea!
Each silvery fish contains a treasure. The cooks are summoned, but they give stammering disavowals, swearing the fish were fresh caught and fed nothing but herbs by the kitchen folk. I frown at my plate, at the beads of sea glass I find beneath my fish's gills. When I look up, Locke holds a single gold coin, perhaps part of a lost mortal ship's hoard.
I see you staring at him, Nikasia says, sitting down beside me.
Tonight, she wears a gown of gold lacework. Her dark tourmaline hair is pulled up with two golden combs, the shape of a shark jaw, complete with golden teeth. Perhaps I am looking only at the trinkets and gold with which your mother thinks she can buy this court's favor, I say. She picks up one of the violets from my plate and places it delicately on her tongue.
I lost Cardin's love for Locke's easy words and easier kisses. Sugared like these flowers, she says. Your sister lost your love to get Locke's, didn't she? But we all know what you lost.
Locke, I laugh.
Good riddance.
Her brows knit together.
Surely it's not the High King himself you were gazing at.
Surely not, I echo, but I don't meet her eyes.
Do you know why you didn't tell anyone my secret?
She asks.
Perhaps you tell yourself that you enjoy having something over my head. But in truth, I think it's that you knew no one would ever believe you. I belong in this world. You don't. And you know it.
You don't even belong on land, sea princess,
I remind her. And yet, I cannot help recalling how the Living Council doubted me. I cannot help how her words crawl under my skin. Someone you trust has already betrayed you.
This will never be your world, mortal, she says. This is mine, I say, anger making me reckless. My land and my king, and I will protect them both. Say the same. Go on.
He cannot love you, she says to me, her voice suddenly brittle.
She obviously doesn't like the idea of my claiming Cardin. Obviously is still infatuated with him. And just as obviously, has no idea what to do about it. What do you want? I ask her. I was just sitting here, minding my own business, eating my dinner. You're the one who came up to me. You're the one accusing me of... I'm not even sure what.
Tell me what you have over him, Nikasia says. How did you trick him into putting you at his right hand? Yum, who he despised and reviled. How is it that you have his ear?
I will tell you, if you tell me something in return. I turn toward her, giving her my full attention. I have been puzzling over the secret passageway in the palace, over the woman in the crystal.
I've told you all that I'm willing to, Nikasia begins.
Not that. Cardin's mother, I say, cutting her off. Who was she? Where is she now? She tries to turn her surprise into mockery.
If you're such good friends, why don't you ask him?
I never said we were friends. A servant with a mouth full of sharp teeth and butterfly wings on his back brings the next course. The heart of a deer, cooked rare and stuffed with toasted hazelnuts. Nikasia picks up the meat and tears into it, blood running over her fingers. She runs her tongue over red teeth.
She wasn't anyone, just some girl from the lower courts. Eldred never made her a consort, even after she'd borne him a child.
I blink in obvious surprise. She looks insufferably pleased, as though my not knowing has proved once and for all how unsuitable I am.
Now it's your turn.
You want to know what I did to make him raise me up? I ask, leaning toward her, close enough that she can feel the warmth of my breath. I kissed him on the mouth, and then I threatened to kiss him some more, if he didn't do exactly what I wanted. Liar, she hisses. If you're such good friends, I say, repeating her own words back to her with malicious satisfaction. Why don't you ask him? Her gaze goes to Cardin, his mouth stained red with heart's blood, crown at his brow. They appear two of a kind, a match set of monsters. He doesn't look over, busy listening to the lutist who has composed, on the spot, a rollicking ode to his rule. My king, I think, but only for a year and a day. And 5 months are already gone. Chapter 9. Tatterfell is waiting for me when I get back to my rooms, her beetle eyes disapproving as she picks up the High King's trousers from my couch.
So this is how you've been living, the little imp grumbles. A worm in a butterfly's cocoon.
Something about being scolded is comfortingly familiar, but that doesn't mean I like it. I turn away so she can't see my embarrassment at how untidy I've let things get, not to mention what it looks like I've been doing, and with whom. Sworn into Matic service until she worked off some old debt of honor, Tatterfell could not have come here without his knowledge. She may have taken care of me since I was a child, brushed my hair, and mended my dresses, and strung rowan berries to keep me from being enchanted. But it is Matic who has her loyalty. It's not that I don't think she was fond of me, in her way, but I've never mistaken that for love. I sigh. The castle servants would have cleaned my rooms if I let them, but then they'd notice my odd hours and be able to rifle through my papers. Not to mention,
my poisons. No, better to bar the door and sleep in filth. My sister's voice comes from my bedroom.
You're back early.
She sticks her head out, holding up a few garments.
Someone you trust has already betrayed you.
How did you get in? I ask. My key turned, met resistance. The tumblers moved. I have been taught the humble art of lockpicking, and though I am no prodigy, I can at least tell when a door is locked in the first place.
Oh, Taryn says, and laughs. I posed as you and got a copy of your key.
I want to kick a wall. Surely everyone knows I have a twin sister. Surely everyone knows mortals can lie. Ought someone not have at least asked a question she might find tricky to answer before handing over access to palace rooms? To be fair, though, I have myself lied again and again and gotten away with it. I can hardly begrudge Taryn for doing the same. It's my bad luck that tonight is when she chooses to barge in. With Cardin's clothing scattered over my rug and a heap of his bloody bandages still on a low table.
I've persuaded Maddock to gift the remainder of Tatterfell's debt to you, Taryn announces. And I've brought you all your coats and dresses and jewels.
I look into the imp's ink-drop eyes.
You mean Maddock has her spying for him?
Tatterfell's lip curls, and I'm reminded how sharply she pinches.
Aren't you a sly and suspicious girl? You ought to be ashamed, saying such a thing.
I am grateful for the times you were kind, I say. If Maddock has given your debt to me, considered it paid long ago. Tatterfell frowns unhappily.
Maddock spared my lover's life when he could have taken it by right. I pledged him 100 years of my service, and that time is nearly up. Do not dishonor my vow by thinking it can be dismissed with a wave of your hand.
I am stung by her words. Are you sorry he sent you?
Not yet, she says,
and goes back to work. I head toward my bedroom, picking up Cardin's bloody rags before Tatterfell can. As I pass the hearth, I toss them into the flames. The fire flares up. So, I ask my sister, what did you bring me? She points to my bed, where she has spread my old things on my newly rumpled sheets. It's odd to see the clothes and jewels I haven't had in months. The things that Maddock bought for me. The things Orianna approved. Tunics, gowns, fighting gear, doublets. Taryn even brought the homespun I used to sneak around Hollow Hall, and the clothes we wore when we snuck to the mortal world. When I look at it all, I see a person who is both me and not. A kid who went to classes and didn't think the stuff she was learning would be all that important. A girl who wanted to impress the only dad she knew, who wanted a place in the court, who still believed in honor. I am not sure I fit in these clothes anymore. Still, I hang them in my closet, beside my two black doublets and a single pair of high boots. I open a box of my jewels, earrings given to me for birthdays, a golden cuff, 3 rings, one with a ruby that Maddock gave me on a blood moon revel, one with his crest that I don't even remember receiving, and a thin gold one that was a present from Orianna. Necklaces of moonstone, chunks of quartz, carved bone. I slide the ruby ring onto my left hand.
And I brought some sketches, she says,
taking out a pad of paper and sitting cross-legged on my bed. Neither of us is a great artist, but her drawings of clothing are easy to understand.
I want to take them to my tailor.
She's imagined me in a lot of black jackets with high collars, the skirts slashed up the sides for easy movement. The shoulders look as though they're armored. And, in a few cases, she has drawn what appears to be a single shiny sleeve of metal.
They can measure me, she says. You won't even have to go to the fittings.
I give her a long look. Taryn doesn't like conflict. Her manner of dealing with all the terror and confusion in our lives has been to become immensely adaptable, like one of those lizards that change color to match their surroundings. She's the person who knows what to wear and how to behave, because she studies people carefully and mimics them. She's good at picking out clothes to send a certain message, even if the message of her drawings appears to be, "Stay away from me, or I will chop off your head." And it's not like I don't think she wants to help me, but the effort she's put into this, especially as her own marriage is imminent, seems extraordinary. "Okay," I say. "What do you want?"
"What do you mean?" she asks.
All innocence. "You want us to be friends again," I say, sliding into more modern diction with her. "I appreciate that. You want me to come to your wedding, which is great, because I want to be there. But this is too much."
"I can be nice," she says,
but does not meet my eyes. I wait. For a long moment, neither of us speaks. I know she saw Cardin's clothes tossed on the floor. Her not immediately asking about that should have been my first clue that she wanted something.
"Fine," she sighs. "It's not a big deal. But there is a thing I want to talk to you about."
"No kidding," I say, but I can't help smiling. She shoots me a look of vast annoyance.
"I don't want Locke to be master of revels."
"You and me both."
"But you could do something about it."
Taryn winds her hands in her skirts.
"Locke craves dramatic experiences. And as master of revels, he can create these, I don't even know what to call them, stories. He doesn't so much think of a party as food and drinks and music, but rather a dynamic that might create conflict."
"Okay," I say, trying to imagine what that means for politics. "Nothing good."
"He wants to see how I'll react to the things he does," she says.
"That's true. He wanted to know, for instance, if Taryn loved him enough to let him court me while she stood by, silent and suffering. I think he'd have been interested in finding out the same about me, but I turned out to be very prickly." She goes on,
"And Cardin, and the circles of the court. He's already been talking to the Larks and the Grackles, finding their weaknesses, figuring out which squabbles he can inflame and how."
"Locke might do the Larks some good," I say. "Give them a ballad to write. As for the Grackles, if he can compete with their debauches, I guess he ought to have at it. Although I am clever enough not to say that out loud."
The way he talks, for a moment, it all seems like it's fun. "Even if it's a terrible idea," Taryn says. "His being master of revels is going to be awful. I don't care about him taking lovers, but I hate him being away from me. Jude, please, do something. I know you want to say you told me so, but I don't care."
"I have bigger problems," I want to tell her. "Maddock would almost certainly say you don't have to marry him. Vivi'd say that too, I bet. In fact, I bet they have.
But you know me too well to bother." She shakes her head. "When I'm with him, I feel like the hero of a story. Of my story. It's when he's not there that things don't feel right."
I don't know what to say to that. I could point out that Taryn seems to be the one making up the story, casting Locke in the role of the protagonist, and herself as the romantic interest who disappears when she's not on the page. But I do remember being with Locke, feeling special and chosen and pretty. Now, thinking about it, I just feel dumb. I guess I could order Cardin to strip the title from Locke, but Cardin would resent my using my power for something so petty and personal. It would make me seem weak. And Locke would figure out that the stripping of his title was my fault, since I haven't made my dislike a secret. He'd know that I had more power over Cardin than quite made sense. And everything Taryn is complaining about would still happen. Locke doesn't need to be the High King's master of revels to get into this kind of trouble. The title just allows him to manage it on a grander scale. I'll talk to Cardin about it, I lie. Her gaze goes to where his clothes were scattered across my floor, and she smiles.
Chapter 10. As the hunter's moon approaches, the level of debauchery in the palace increases. The tenor of the parties changes. They become more frenetic, more wild. No longer is Cardin's presence necessary for such license. Now that rumors paint him as someone who would shoot a lover for sport, his legend grows from there. Recollections of his younger days, of the way he rode a horse into our lessons, the fights he had, the cruelties he perpetrated, are picked over. The more horrible the story, the more it is cherished. Fairies may not be able to lie, but stories grow here as they do anywhere, fed on ambition and envy and desire. In the afternoons, I step over sleeping bodies in the halls. Not all of them are courtiers. Servants and guards seem to have fallen prey to the same wild energy and can be found abandoning their duties to pleasure. Naked folk run across the gardens of Elfheim, and troughs once used to water horses now run with wine. I meet with Volsiber, seeking more information about the Undersea, but he has none. Despite knowing that Nikasia was trying to bait me, I go over the list of people who may have betrayed me. I fret over who and to what end, over the arrival of Lord Roybin's ambassador, over how to extend my year and a day lease on the throne. I wished I'd asked Cardin for his true name back when I had a crossbow trained on him. I study my moldering papers, and drink my poisons, and plan 1,000 parries to blows that may never come. Cardin has moved to Eldred's old chambers, and the rooms with the burnt floor are barred from the inside. If it makes him uncomfortable to sleep where his father slept, he gives no sign. When I arrive, he is lounging nonchalantly as servants remove tapestries and divans to make room for a new bed carved to his specifications. He is not alone. A small circle of courtiers is with him. A few I don't know. Plus Locke, Nikasia, and my sister, currently pink with wine and laughing on the rug before the fire.
Go,
he says to them when he sees me at the threshold.
But your majesty, begins a girl.
She's all cream and gold, in a light blue gown. Long pale antennae rise from the outer edges of her eyebrows.
Surely such dull news as your seneschal brings will require the antidote of our cheer.
I've thought carefully about commanding Cardin. Too many orders, and he'd chafe under them. Too few, and he'd duck beneath them easily. But I am glad to have made sure he'd never deny me admittance. I am especially glad that he can never countermand me.
I am sure I will call you back swiftly enough,
Cardin says, and the courtiers troop out merrily. One of them carries a mug, obviously stolen from the mortal world and filled to the brim with wine. I rule, it reads. Locke shoots me a curious glance. My sister grabs hold of my hand as she goes, squeezing it hopefully. I go to a chair and sit down without waiting for an invitation. I want to remind Cardin that over me, he has no authority. The Hunter's Moon revel is tomorrow night, I say. He sprawls in a chair opposite mine, watching me with his black eyes as though I am the one to be wary of.
If you wish to know details, you ought to have kept Locke behind. I know little. It is to be another one of my performances. I shall caper while you scheme.
Orla of the Undersea is watching you.
Everyone's watching me,
Cardin says, fingers fiddling restlessly with his signet ring, turning it round and round again. You don't seem to mind, I say. You said yourself that you don't hate being king. Maybe you're even enjoying it. He gives me a suspicious look. I try to give him a genuine smile in return. I hope I can be convincing.
I need to be convincing. We can both have what we want. You can rule for a lot